Cambridge Hospital Alliance, and he spent 28 years there, and he used to run the primary care residency, so we're very glad to have his perspective on another difficult situation.
Marge, thanks a lot for bringing the Dan, Dave, and Dave together. It's really interesting how idiosyncratic our situations are, but the themes are quite similar. You know, as I was sitting looking at the public at the disclosure, I guess I really do have something to disclose, which is that I have worked for 29 years at one place. It's a public hospital. I've been supported primarily to take care of poor people and to advocate for poor people. And I've been supported mainly by taxes efficiently collected by the government, and taxes that are not regressive taxes, but part of my salary really does come from regressive taxes collected by insurance companies. When I talk to the intern applicants or medical students who are coming to the Cambridge Hospital, Cambridge City Hospital, Cambridge Health Alliance, I usually say something like, never in my career have I had to turn away a patient because of their inability to pay, because of their race, their class, and the like. And then I pause, and I said, what kind of comment is that about healthcare in America, that should be true? A couple weeks ago, I ran into, I saw this statue of Daedalus on top of the highest hill in Amman, Jordan. And as you can see, he's looking upward towards Icarus, his son, who's flown, but he's come too close to the sun. And the wax that held his wings together melted. And the expression on his face is an expression of horror, of disappointment, perhaps of shame. And this is a story of hubris. And I'm afraid that the story that you're going to hear me tell is a story of hubris. So I want to talk a little bit about what I call the covenant between Cambridge Health Alliance and the people that we serve in the Cambridge Health Alliance, and the Commonwealth, CHA, and the communities. I want to talk about the fracturing of that covenant and then possibly cobbling it together into the future. This public hospital was founded at the end of the First World War, and it was known as a place that took care of very poor people and only very poor people. It was known as a patronage sink for city councilors, and it was known for really lousy quality care delivered mainly by foreign medical graduate residents who by 1966 were not working every third night or every other night, but actually every night for their year at Cambridge Hospital, Cambridge City Hospital. This was so embarrassing to the city of Cambridge and to Harvard University when an NBC white paper was shown that it forced those two groups to get together and to change Cambridge City Hospital to give it new birth as the Cambridge Hospital, a new name, a new building. And they were able to recruit an academic faculty for the first time to start residency programs and to focus their activity on primary care. And that period went until 1996. And then it was the Cambridge Hospital was now reformed in 1997 as a public authority, no longer a department within the city of Cambridge, but rather chartered by the state legislature to be active in these five towns north of the Charles River. Boston is down here, and the river goes up through here. And these are where we are active. And as you can see, as Cambridge became more and more gentrified, and the poor people who we care for gradually moved northeast, we gradually changed our focus. So the covenant is an agreement between the state legislature, representing the people we serve, and Cambridge Health Alliance to do these three general things. One is to assemble an integrated health system, and we have done that. We have now 20 neighborhood health centers in these towns. We ran three hospitals in Cambridge, Somerville, and the town of Everett. We run the health department for the city of Cambridge, and Claude, the director of the health department, is here. And we consult the health departments in the other towns, and we have a physicians organization. This insurance company is a Medicaid expansion that has about 175,000 members across the entire state, and it was one of the ways that Massachusetts chose to insure uninsured patients. During this time, we accrued the breadth that we did in part on behest of state legislatures, legislators representing their constituencies to save failing hospitals. So when the Somerville Hospital was on the verge of bankruptcy, the local state legislator and the mayor at the time is now our state representative, Mr. Capuano, they said, you know, it makes sense, actually this was partly my idea, it makes sense to wrap the license of Cambridge Health Alliance around some of these health centers and these dying hospitals, because we as a public institution are able to leverage disproportionate share monies through Medicaid, which is a match between the state and the federal government. And with the increased rate of payment that we get, we could save these community hospitals, we could save these health centers. And more importantly, or as important, we can save the decaying psychiatric care in the state. So when the Metropolitan State Hospital was closed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, we took on two of their psych wards. And when the Heritage Hospital was closed, we took on their psychiatric ward, and so on and so forth. And like the other hospitals you've heard, we have attracted over the years staff, and not just the medical staff, but the entire staff who are committed to public medicine, committed to taking care of poor people, and very interested in partnering with any number of community organizations. And we have these kinds of programming, which you see in just about every public hospital system. We're actually very proud of this. Perhaps I speak with a little bit of hyperbole, but that you heard my disclosure. So in the breadth, I guess the one thing I haven't mentioned, about 40% of our patients are immigrants and don't speak English as a first language. By last year, at the peak, we gave out a third of all indigent psychiatric care in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, a third. And that's primarily because no one else wanted these patients. And we've won any number of awards, and we can talk at another point about how one wins an award. And we've achieved many of these quality measures, and we can talk at another time. And you've heard David talk about how one achieves well in these quality measures and what they may mean. But most of all, I think the greatest source of pride is kind of the respectfulness that people have for one another who work in this institution, the respectfulness that they have for the patients who we serve. This is a Winslow Homer painting, Breezing Up, that probably everyone here has seen before. Winslow Homer was born in Cambridge, is buried in the Mount Auburn Cemetery. And in this projection, you don't see how dark those clouds are. But the perfect storm came to us last year as the convergence of three themes. One was the recession and the deterioration of the Massachusetts economy and the tax base that has supported the public programming in the Commonwealth. The second is a history of about 10 or 15 years of deregulation, which I'll talk of the so-called marketplace, which I'll talk about a bit. And the third is healthcare reform in Massachusetts, which is the model for the healthcare reform that you see coming through Congress right now. We made a different choice than the choices you've heard. We actually made a deal with the state government that said, we will close a lot of these practices, a lot of these health centers, a lot of these hospitals, and do away with a lot of the psychiatric care if you will keep us alive for a few more years, with the promise that in the future things will be better, and we will put ourselves up as a model integrated healthcare system that will be more fiscally responsible, not that we haven't been, but will be something that the state will be proud of as an example of an accountable care organization. But in that deal, We closed the Somerville Hospital inpatient service, really too small a service to legitimately remain it's open. We closed six community health centers, some of them serving communities where almost everyone spoke one or another language in our communities. Our languages are primarily Portuguese, number one, and Spanish, Haitian Creole, and 60 or 70 others. We closed about a third of the psychiatric inpatient and ambulatory services. This means 80,000 or so ambulatory psychiatric visits a year. And where will those patients get care? Well, we hope in their own communities. We're narrowing our geographical scope and trying to figure out how, within the realm of professional dignity, one turns over the care of a patient to where? We've laid off about 450 or so workers. And as one might imagine, what happens to an institution that goes through this is a complete change in the kind of spirit of the place. And my job as a leader in the institution is to talk about tomorrow that's actually going to be a brighter future. The next couple of years are going to be the most interesting years of my career, trying to put together an accountable care organization that will make sense, that will be better shepherds of public resources, and stick with us. And I've seen about 20% of my department disappear in the last year. So let me talk about first, so I'm now going to explain in a way what's happened. First, a little bit about the context of healthcare reform, and then I'll talk about healthcare reform. Massachusetts is known as a state that is rather generous, and generous with public money and public resources. We think of ourselves as communitarian and innovative. We aren't the home of the first public hospital. I realize that it is here in the city of Philadelphia, but Benjamin Franklin went to Boston Latin School. At the time a few years ago, the economic well-being of Massachusetts was pretty good compared with the rest of the nation, and because of the public largesse, we had about the lowest rate of uninsured in the state. And this came from a very complicated scheme where health insurers, the public, and private hospitals put money into a free care pool, and that money was then redistributed to take care of underinsured patients. And then our Republican governor of the time wanted to be president and actually saw that, since he came out very strongly as pro-choice, that the way he was going to run for, that's before he became anti-choice, that he was going to run for president on the basis of putting together a model national health system within Massachusetts. Of great interest is the deregulation of the market in Massachusetts. Until about 10 or 15 years ago, there was a rate-setting commission that was a public commission that really looked at the rates that insurance companies would charge and truly regulated this. And there was a determination of need process, which again was a public process, that required any hospital that wanted to build anything new to go through a series of public hearings. And those two elements were, I wouldn't say completely disbanded, but the teeth in those were really removed. So these edentulous organizations still exist. That handshake you see down there was reported in the Boston Globe earlier this year. It's a handshake between the president of Partners and the president of Blue Cross. Partners is the conglomeration of the Massachusetts General Hospital and the Brigham and a bunch of community hospitals in an ever-expanding web of individuals, of organizations. And in that handshake was the following deal. Partners was putting the squeeze on Blue Cross. They said, pay us more, pay us more, pay us more. And Blue Cross finally said, look, we'll make a deal with you. We'll pay you more, but we'll pay you more under the condition that with the other major insurers, you pay them more also. And what happened is that the cost of medical care in Massachusetts has escalated over the years, and a huge amount of money has gone to Partners in exclusion of just of almost all the other hospitals in the state. So this case is actually fascinating. That leverage that they had through that handshake allowed them to receive rates from the three largest insurers, which, according to the Boston Globe's calculations, is in excess of $800 million a year, excess of funding compared to any other hospital their size. And what they do with that money is invest it in buying community hospitals and in creating high-tech diagnostic centers throughout the state, and in this bid up the cost of medical care. And they invest billions of dollars, as you can see, in capital. And their clout grows and grows. And the clout is not just an economic clout, but it's a clout which finds its way into the political system. This is a very brief explanation of how healthcare is financed. So this is my hospital. Imagine on the x-axis is the rate of compensation for care. And so for Medicare, we're paid almost what it costs to deliver care. And Medicaid pays much less, and commercial insurers pay much less, and I'll get to that in a moment. The health safety net pays even less, and we're supported in the end by these subsidies that come as disproportionate share funds and a bunch of other monies cobbled together by the state, which paid us above cost. Now, it's interesting that and the size of each of these rectangles, the area in the rectangle, is approximately the amount of revenues that come into the hospital. So, interesting that the commercial, where's that pointer go? That the commercial insurers pay us less than Medicaid. And that happens because we have no clout, and particularly no clout compared to the big boys on the block. Network Health, the insurance company that we run, generates several millions of dollars of revenues, which instead of being invested to capitalize this as an insurer, gets invested in a deal with the state in helping the operating costs of CHA. This is somewhat different from the typical academic health center, where the mean cost of care is substantially greater. The amount that they're paid by Medicaid is greater because the case mix is higher, and the case mix is higher because they do tertiary and quaternary care. But that also means that, and the same thing is true of the way Medicaid is paid, but that means that Medicaid is paid at the average rate of care. So when they take care of a patient with pneumonia, they're paid at this rate, rather than this rate, because their average costs are higher. They are able to cost shift from commercial insurance, which pays above cost, to the other, to balance out the public funding. We're not able to do that. And that's the situation. In big picture, it sounds like some things that are very interesting, and I thank David Himmelstein and Steffi Woolhandler, who are in my department, for these slides. If you look at the typical Boston teaching hospital, it's only about a third of their income that comes from private sources. All of the rest are really public sources, public sourcing. So to think that the public doesn't, that we want, that when the right says we don't want the, you know, to build a big public system, we have a big public system. It just doesn't get governed as a big public system. And here's the approximate amount of revenue that comes into each of the hospitals in Boston compared to Cambridge Health Alliance in terms of the amount that's public. These are the profits in 2007 of the hospitals in our area. And I'm told that this year, the combination of Mass General and the Brigham accumulated 60% of all profits of all hospitals in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Though we, Cambridge Health Alliance, had 90% of our funds came from public money, the total amount of public money that we get is much less than of the larger hospitals. So again, where these are publicly supported institutions, not private institutions. If one looks at the Dartmouth Atlas about the cost of care in the last 2 years of life, you can see that the cost of care at Cambridge Health Alliance is lower than it is for most of the other downtown hospitals. And this is not just a phenomenon for Cambridge Health Alliance, but this is a national phenomenon of public hospitals. We actually do it well, we do it with integrity, and we do it less expensively. So this is what Governor Romney had to say about the mass health care reform, and I'm going to talk now, switch gears a little bit to talk about health care reform. Every uninsured citizen, see this as citizen, not resident or person who happens to reside in the Commonwealth, will soon have affordable, which should be in italics, health insurance, not health care, and the costs of health care will be reduced. And as you can see, there are a bunch of problems in this sentence. I don't really have to spend much time on this, because actually the shape of Massachusetts healthcare reform is very much the shape of what you see coming out of Congress. What is very hard to find in the newspaper reports of what was passed by the House of Representatives is what's on the last line there, which is in the financing of healthcare reform, what is going to happen to the safety net? And what we saw happen in Massachusetts is that they took the disproportionate share money and they're reinvesting that money in private insurance instead of paying it to the safety net. So for us, what happens in mass health care reform is that this big line of subsidies is being zeroed out. And zeroed out means that there's really nothing to offset the underpayment that we get from all the other public sources and from the commercial source. Now, we've been able to renegotiate with the commercial payers, so they're going to pay us above Medicaid, but not above cost. Network Health, the insurance company, is being cherry-picked by the state. And I wouldn't say under the influence of partners, which has this all the political clout that I talked about before. So you didn't hear me say that. But what's happened with Network Health is that the least expensive patients who we take care of in the western part of the state have been eliminated from Network Health. And another group of patients, immigrants of special status, these are people with green cards who are awaiting their citizenship, who've had a green card for less than 5 years, we're no longer able to insure them. We know from historically that this part of the patient population underutilizes resources, and thus they've been cherry-picked out of Cambridge Health Alliance. We have to turn over their care. We have to break relationships that we've had with these patients sometimes for many years and turn them over to a for-profit insurance company that's contracted only with Caritas, which is the Catholic health organization that doesn't offer abortion, but maybe that's not an issue anymore, or, of all people, partners. The other thing that's happened in Massachusetts with healthcare reform is that there, as I showed, that the costs were supposed to be contained, they haven't been, the costs continue to escalate. So the consequences of reform for us is that it's very clear that this is about insurance reform, it's not about health reform or health care reform. And it's clear that health is not health, or access to health is not a right. The uninsured patients that went down statewide by 50% to 70%, 75% for us have only reduced themselves by about 20%. And we will see sooner or later what else is to happen. That access to insurance doesn't mean access to care. The insurance that the very poor are getting is like a Medicaid, and they really pretty much have access to all of our services. But for anyone above 150% of poverty, they have to pay copays and on a sliding scale monthly premiums, which really means that they have less access. And what we've seen is that the emergency room visits all of a sudden have increased. Not all of a sudden, they've continued to increase over the years, but they continue to increase. And in our primary care practices, we're seeing more and more no-shows, we're seeing more and more patients with unfilled prescriptions. And as I mentioned before, the care of the patients who are most able to care for, where we are most culturally competent, those patients are being stripped from our care under our primary care. The staff is dispirited. And ultimately, I, as I said, stand before the medical staff to say there will be a new day. And I really think that in this relationship with the state, we'll be able to cobble together something. When one asks the patients what they think of healthcare reform, in the Boston Globe they say that two-thirds of the people of Massachusetts support the mandate, but if you ask the people who are actually cared for, affected by healthcare reform, the minority of them affect mandate. And if you ask people who are affected whether the law has hurt them, half of them say yes. But if you ask the public, it's very popular in the state. Well, this is another Winslow Homer painting called The Rescue. And there's some ambiguity in this picture as to whether the rescuer has his eyes averted from the horror that he's pulling in these two bodies, or whether this is really a strong man looking towards the coast and he's pulling in these women who he's actually saved. It's up to you, and I guess up to us, to try to imagine what that actually means. The lessons that I take from all of this are the following. The safety net really is being shredded in Massachusetts. We're the last surviving public hospital. And if what's happened in Massachusetts is going to happen nationwide, this is a big problem. And what's being lost? What's being lost is just what you've heard from Dan and Dave. We offer less expensive, uniquely, culturally, and socially excellent care. We've spent decades building community trust, which, if fractured, is very hard to cobble together again. We've trained idealistic and culturally competent future health professionals, and we are the voices of and researchers for advocacy. You don't have to be crazy to be paranoid, and maybe it's not my paranoia alone to think that this is all intentional to do away with the advocates for the poor, but I'm worried. The determinants of this are in part the reform, but it's really the whole structure of the so-called deregulated, so-called market of healthcare, which is the problem. And it gets to be more complicated in moments of recession. In the United States and US healthcare reform, health is not a human right. It's really access to insurance, which we're talking about. And the solution, to me, is surely continued advocacy, and there has to be a single-payer system. So when I look back at this statue of Daedalus, I think that if we could have a single-payer system rather than the mess that we have cobbled together with wax, we would be much better off. And if we believe that healthcare were truly a right of the citizenry, then perhaps Icarus would fly. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I've always felt that there's sort of a very special and sort of commitment and esprit that comes from working in a public institution, and I think you heard that this afternoon. So our panelists have described the budget slashing and the service reductions and the beds that are lost and the people that have been laid off. They've also described the sort of local politics, business, recession, and different local issues that have sort of made this disaster happen, and also how the public resources that actually are available are not going to what services are needed by the poor and the documented and the undocumented, the uninsured, and really all of us. So I'm sure they're interested in sort of a cross exchange, but really hearing from the nice people who are in this room as well, and your experiences about what we really can do to stem the tide of this sort of assault on the public system, and obviously in the context of the discussions that are going on right now in terms of changing the healthcare system. So, comments, Simon?
Yeah, that was fascinating. I work at Cook County, and hearing about Grady, especially paralleling what's going on now, and David touched on a lot of that. But I was just wondering, there's actually some links here. For example, these consultants getting paid millions of dollars to say certain things. My first question has to do with, is there ever a consultant that says, build the system up, make it better? My experience is the opposite. At Cook County, they are hiring consultants, some of them are the same ones, including Alvarez and Marcel, that say, sell everything off, give it away. You'll save money. Well, you won't really care, but you save money. So I'm wondering if there's ever a role for these consultants. That's one thing. Secondly, my understanding is that our system, which David described very well as far as how it runs, as how it's being run now, they're looking at other systems, how they work, how well they do. And from the most recent thing, and this is late-breaking news, they are now looking at the Grady system as an exemplary example of how to run a healthcare system and how it works very well. So I'm wondering if in our future is privatization of the whole system. I mean, they're trying to privatize some clinics now, and I'm going to discuss that in my thing tomorrow, but I'm wondering if you could give me a positive response. Like, is it good that they're looking at Grady or the Cook County system?
I think the jury is still out, but when the positive thing that's happened for Grady is it's had a large infusion of capital resources. So a lot of the aging and the non-functional equipment is being replaced. So that's good. In terms of operating funds, they're still in the same situation that they were in before, and the hospital is essentially run as a kind of a Ponzi scheme where you pay today's creditors with current income, or the far out creditors with current income, putting off the day's creditors, and how long that can continue, I don't know. So that's why I said I feel like I need to come back next year and tell you how this is all working out. So to answer your question about consultants, they say we ought to build things up and make it better. I mean, I told them that for free. But the paid consultants, yeah, tell you how to get rid of services.
I will say something about paid consultants. We actually had two paid consultants who were helpful. And
what's the name?
Well, the individuals were Mark Finucane and Bruce Vladek. And they were helpful partly because they were very knowledgeable, they came from the public sector, and they were able to walk into the State House and say, we have audited this institution and we can tell you they are well run. And trust them. And frankly, that was really, really helpful.
So the gentleman from Chicago, thanks for the presentation. My name is Nelson from CDC in Atlanta. I was wondering if you can explain or expand a little bit more on the FTE to the adjusted bed ratio that you presented. Because it's possible that those hospitals might not be attending to similar clientele. It's possible that an hospital that is located in an area only serving a marginalized population, which means that the ratio might be a little bit higher in some section of the hospital as opposed to hospital or clinic that are serving people that are a little bit healthier. And the implication of that to the employee layoffs that you mentioned, I'm very interested in that because if the ratio is a little bit high, and it's possible that employees might not be laid off.
Yeah. So there may be people in this room who understand this better than I. My understanding about it is that it's really based upon charges. So that there's charges in the inpatient sector and charges for outpatient care and for various kinds of testing that exist. And that, you know, so of course, you know, to be in the hospital costs, you know, in the range of thousands of dollars in a day. To do an outpatient visit is in the range of, you know, $100 per day. So the idea is that how many visits are you generating and how well they're coded and then packaged in terms of being a set of charges that can then be put on a similar metric of how much, it's not how much money you're bringing into the institution, but how much work is being done in the framework of charges. And so it really is a kind that seems to me, not being schooled in this stuff, but it seems to me that it's a thing that really puts outpatient care at a disadvantage because inpatient care is paid for better and therefore charged very differently. So it puts outpatient care at a disadvantage, and you can have a highly productive system with lots of outpatient visits looking charges.
Yeah, I'm David. I'm a pediatrician at Stroger Hospital. I suppose my job is one of the opportunities that's been identified by the consultants since they're going to eliminate my department. But parallel between Grady and County that jumped out at me was this business of using public money to capitalize an institution which at the moment is public, but the trajectory of which is, you know, crisis and collapse, such that it can be then cannibalized by the private institutions that might be able to use those resources. I mean, Stroger Hospital is a beautiful building, only a few years old. The neonatal intensive care unit that I work in is state-of-the-art, very nice. And you can almost, you know, see them salivating at the adjacent private institution, Rush, which we are supposed to be like merged with, thank you very much. So I think one of the problems that all of us have is to really conceptualize the profundity of the evil which is taking place. I think Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, is helpful and instructive in this regard. I think crises of the type that destroy the public sector are largely engineered in the current period, and they're not designed to do any of the things that the comforting buzzwords of our CEOs would tell us.
Thank you, everybody. This was great. I'm just trying to think where to begin. So, consultants. I think one of the things that, you know, you mentioned some positive things about consultants. I think one of the most consistent things that I saw happening with consultants when I was at County is that they would come through looking for all this waste and inefficiency, and they wouldn't be able to find it. And so, you know, in one department, and they use horrible metrics. It's worth a whole session to talk about how flawed their methodology is. But even though they're, you know, paid by the dollar that they could cut, in most cases, they really couldn't find these inefficiencies. And so there's a very short memory about that. And so probably collectively, we should put all our stories together about, you know, even if they find 10% inefficiencies, there's 90% that we're working way over capacity, seeing many more patients than anybody else. And these people have the numbers, and they either hide them or people forget about them. The next thing is the short memory about privatization. So County has had a long experience with privatization. In fact, Provident itself, hospital, started out as a privatization experiment. We sent OB to this place and TB to that place, and we contracted out housekeeping. And almost every one of these privatization schemes, nursing privatization and registries, these were all disastrous in terms of the quality of people we got, the cost, the corruption. So that's another part of the sort of short memory that's worth.
Did it ever go back? Once privatized was.
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I think I can't remember the whole. It seemed like housekeeping went back and forth, but of course there is this inexorable push because it gets rid of the unions,
yeah,
and it gets rid of, you know, lower pay. But sometimes they have to come back, and of course. So, but the other thing is, it's interesting that you three folks are sort of, I wouldn't say top leaders, but you're sort of middle level managers, and. Part of when we used to have these sessions at APHA years ago, we were much more sort of bottom up and talking about the movements. And I know there are movements that you guys are, you know, alluded to, but I think we should really be thinking more about where are the patients, where is the organizing. I mean, to some extent, people have been discouraged and beaten back. And of course, once you start this downward spiral that the hospital is no good because they've made so many cuts and people don't want to go there. But hopefully that's not totally in a tailspin, that we can't mobilize people. And so that wasn't part of the discussion, but obviously it should be on everybody's mind. And I guess the last thing is, I mean, I guess there's some hospitals that we didn't talk about, like San Francisco General or Parkland was briefly mentioned, or Denver. And I don't know, these are held out frequently. I mean, I was recently at San Francisco General, and it just felt like I was going home to Cook County 20 years ago. There was a sense of optimism and people wanting to come there and hope and recruiting young people and activists. And so again, once you start turning that around, you know, to the other situation that we had at County where you couldn't in good faith tell people this was the greatest place to work and train, hopeful, new people, commitment. Again, every talk alluded to it. It's just somebody's got to figure out how to measure this. You know, Dave and Steffi have to help us figure out how to measure it. Some new economic measure. You know, people talk about social capital, but that just doesn't cut it in terms of the real value of this. Again, you know, David talked about the language competence being disrupted. So that's another thing I think we should, you know, harvest from these presentations and actually figure out how to be go on the offensive related to that.
Gordy, let me respond to the part about a movement, because we had a real short-lived as it was, a real movement that developed around saving Grady Hospital, and the movement was Save Grady. There was not any unanimity or even any position taken by most of the people in this movement about how Grady should be saved. So many people thought that the state should provide just support for Grady, you know, trauma network and the burn center, but there's no real support from the state. Well, the state wasn't about to do that. The state's just cutting back. There are patients that come from the surrounding counties to Grady, and so there was a position that the surrounding counties ought to pay their fair share, to which the surrounding county said, oh, oh, oh. There was the privatization initiative. There were people who said, no, we've got to keep it public. We just have to get more money from the counties to support it. So there was a movement. It was Save Grady. People were wearing pins that said Save Grady. They were turning out in large numbers to save Grady, but nobody was quite sure how to save Grady. And so in the end, the corporate interests gained control.
Other comments? Okay, this
may be a simplistic way of that I'm thinking. So I trained at University of North Carolina. We had a dean come in not that long ago who was previously in the Reagan administration. His whole idea was, literally the day he hit town, he said, UNC, forget the public institution and what it owes the state, this is gonna be a for-profit institution. And started cutting, of course, the low-wage laborers and figuring out how we could change the bed sheets less to save money. And you're thinking, in along that analogy, the handshake, how one conversation in a boardroom with some of the places where we were spending millions and millions of dollars could have saved that. But I guess just the idea that our public institutions are under attack for losing money, and fingers are pointed at you all and all the departments, and a lot of folks represent in this room, and it's such a kind of just the argument is like you're the responsible ones for losing the money when you're just taking the system, you're taking the patients that no one across town wants to take, you're taking insurances that public and private don't cover the cost of the care, and ultimately that somehow in a kind of way of sound bites is allowed to be summed up in, well, these folks can't do the job, so let's bring in the big money interest. These folks obviously are not fiscally responsible to run these public institutions. So I guess I'm just along the lines of the movement thinking there just has to be some sort of way that we politely and very simply point out that we're not the ones in this room failing, but to run, you know, if the goal ultimately is not to lose money, it's not you three or anyone else in this room who's losing the money. Your hands are tied. It's the people who are, you know, the people across town who are making money off the money you're losing it are the ones you should be looking at a little more carefully. But how that seems just a very simplistic way of me thinking through it. How is that able to be, how's the finger always pointed at the public institutions?
Ollie,
do you want to say? I just want to say, I mean, this was an absolutely fabulous panel, and what we ought to do is find a place where this can in fact be published. I mean, you've done some wonderful work so that it in fact gets out to a larger audience. And I agree with Gordy, it'd be great to have the grassroots movement, but again, we all know the difficulty of building that within the communities that these hospitals serve. I mean, it's not simple by any means. And I'm delighted to hear that some of you think that we should in fact have a single payer national health insurance program, because I think, again, for the stability of the future of these institutions, that is really the solution. So you know, let's find a place where this material can be published. Let's try to get it out to a larger public. It's fantastic.
Sounds good. Thank you. I think, unless you guys have comments.
Well, you know, Gordy, the thing, I mean, Ollie, the thing that what continually comes back to me is this voice that says, on the other side, you've got to get government out of healthcare. But government is so much in it that it doesn't behave like government.
Right.
And that's the problem. I mean, the government is not governing. And they've let really corporate interests run willy-nilly over them and over us.
Can I say one? Oh, just in preparing for this, I looked through all the county budgets for the last 10 years and looked at what was the appropriated money for the health system and saw that the rate of inflation was 2.6%, whereas healthcare inflation, you all know, was like in the 6% range. Now, I couldn't link it with services yet, and I think it would be a fascinating thing to sort of take that days and visits and, you know, ER visits and things like that to try and get a composite picture. You know, I know we grew a bunch in the early part of this decade and it contracted some in the latter part. My sense is that it still is a good value for the dollar in terms of everything that's happened and, you know, sort of trying to function in this sea of instability, you know, that other health systems have no clue about. You know, so I think this issue in terms of trying to figure out ways to sort of say that this is a good value is incredibly important.
I hope I'm not repeating something. I've had to be in and out of the meeting, but one of the things we've used is to look at the Dartmouth data about the cost of care in the last 2 years. Shall I have someone else say this?
No.
Okay, yeah. But because that does allow you, that's considered very good control for the patient acuity if they're in the last 2 years of life. And when we looked at it, the public hospitals all have much lower costs than their private counterparts. And it's actually very, very convincing data, and it's being kicked around a lot in the national discourse, so that may be something useful. Just go to the Dartmouth website and look up Cook County.
Okay.
Just
one last comment. You talk about losing money. If you regard healthcare, the access to care, and the necessities to sustain life optimally, in a WHO definition, then the business of government is to provide justice. As if, you know, you wouldn't want to make money off of, although that's changing too, off of, administering justice, whether it be adjudicating disputes among citizens,
like privatized prisons.
Right. But, civil rights, we don't make money off of civil rights. We don't make money off of supporting the basic fundamental rights of democracy, right? So, there you go.
Right. It would be nice to think about that would be a paradigm for us.
It is the job of government, to defend its citizens.
I think people are getting ready to leave. I just should make an announcement. I think there is a demonstration sponsored by the Harvard School of Public Health students at, do you know where it is?
Starting right now.
13th and Arch.
Arch and 13th and Arch. So it's sort of it's against Cigna, and it has a bunch of confusing demands, but I'm sure they want to join them, and I hope we do. Okay? Thank you very, very much, and thank you to the DDD campaign here. And let's try to make their work happen in there. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah.